Hello and welcome to the Tales of Sada and Medu, the stories and events from the post-apocalyptic fantasy realm of Ersa Latari, and the political intrigue of the faded jewel of a diminished empire. Thank you very much for taking the time to listen to the pilot episode 0, and thank you for your feedback on the content. Episode 1 was produced as a minimum viable product and a proof of concept designed solely to get the project moving. Hopefully this will explain why the episode is a 15-minute advert for Audio Jungle. Now I can assure you that I have taken the dive and splashed out for a subscription to Soundstripe, as well as purchasing myself a voice modulator. Hopefully as the project moves forwards, I will have the opportunity to further improve the audio experience by purchasing better kit and equipment, as well as getting guests to record character voices. Really pleased with how things are progressing, really, really appreciate the support, so please sit back and enjoy episode 1, The City Guard, part 1. It was hard enough keeping the city from descending into anarchy without having to dodge and evade Captain Lorboa and his incessant requests for an RSVP to his wedding. It wasn't that the commander disliked the captain. In fact, he was rather fond of him, most days. The challenge was that he did not enjoy giving speeches or taking part in grand ceremonies. This was exactly what the Ironsides had asked him to do when their rather pushy letters arrived, requesting that Samael serve as both the official and the first man on their son's happy occasion. Lorboa was not short of friends or admirers. Most would bite off the commander's hand for the chance to take centre-left stage during the event of the year. The simple fact was that Sam did not want to do it. He wasn't exactly sure why he felt so strongly about it, and made weak excuses to himself about hypocrisy and religion, growing security concerns, and not wanting too many high-ranking guardsmen in the same place at the same time. Given the current state of the city, these concerns were not invalid, but he knew there was something more to his obstructive resistance. Something he did not have the time nor the emotional energy to spend thinking about. So instead, the commander was sneaking about the place like a common criminal. Or, more accurately, a most uncommon criminal. There were few criminals in the underbelly of Sada and Medu, bold enough to break into the commander's office at the New Heath station house. Not only was New Heath constantly crawling with skinners, but there were also few who wished to tangle with the guard QRF, or the political crimes division housed within. Even the boldest of the families, or the Quiet Knives, did their level best to avoid direct contact with either. Wearing his most nondescript civilian attire, and moving slowly with nonchalance and confidence, the commander had barely made it past the first set of doors before being accosted from behind by Lieutenant Lycurgus Moon.
"Do you have any idea the trouble you're in, Squishy?"
intoned the deep, throaty tones with a hint of the Tuskar lilt. The commander's shoulders slumped, and his head lolled forward. He reached slowly up to his head to remove the short, rimmed headdress he had agonized over choosing for his disguise, before speaking. "You'll never take me alive, Skinner. I know what you lot get up to in here, and I'll never submit to the tyranny of paperwork." Samuel laughed jovially, while still trying to keep his voice low, lest he be discovered by someone else. "Were you waiting for me here, Lieutenant? I do hope you have better things to do with your time than try and impress your commander by catching him every time he wishes to use his private entrance."
"I have plenty to keep myself busy, sir. I would be remiss if I did not remind you that according to Part 1 orders, effective as of the first day of E in the Year of Faithful Service, the commander's entrance is to be used for loading and unloading of supplies to the station house only."
Lycurgus proudly responded, reeling off the details as if he was still serving in the Royal Land Forces. "That still does not explain what you are doing here, Lieutenant Moon," replied the commander, slowly turning around to face the hulking, grey-skinned mass. Lycurgus' face relaxed from its mock officiousness and met the stare of the commander.
"Nobby saw you get out of your carriage north of the Green. I paid him 2 pieces of silver and a night of free drinks if he wore me off."
He spoke softly now, with just a hint of a smile.
Generous, I know, but I had suspected that Constable Von Overton was going to make a similar offer. And I know just how much you are looking forward to giving her your answer, and letting her know that on the day of her nuptials with Captain Ironside, you will be...
The Lieutenant smirked as he paused, extending the last word just a little to invite the Commander's response. After a few awkward moments of silence, the towering mass began to show his discomfort, instinctively stroking the scar across his skin, before rubbing his thumb over one of the short, chipped tusks protruding from his lower jaw. Lycurgus and the Commander were old friends, but Moon had never quite shaken his martial indoctrination, which kicked in uncomfortably in moments like this, reminding him that he was, oh, so many ranks below the man he was teasing so casually. Sam knew this, of course, and often gave Lycurgus the look, which meant he would trigger this reptilian response, an emotionless, deadpan stare, ever so subtly with a raised eyebrow. He could not hold it for long, and broke into a wide smile. I really do appreciate the effort, Ly. Is there any way you could get me to my office without being waylaid by any more of my job's worth officers? Asked the Commander with false demurement.
Indeed I can, sir. Just put these shackles on and throw a Hessian sack over your head, and we'll be right as rain.
Lycurgus responded, pulling a set of manacles from his polished leatherwork belt and gesturing with a nod to a pile of empty crates littered with Hessian material from a recent delivery. As the Commander walked tentatively over to the crate and cautiously reached for the cloth, Lycurgus spoke again.
By the silent god, sir, you really do commit.
Part 2. Listen and enjoy. She was sick of this. Not in the natural, entitled way that other people were fed up. No. She was well and truly done. She'd scraped by for years on the borders of the Darkland with her family before they were forced out. Her elderly parents expiring on the road. She'd endured taunts, ridicule, beatings, and worse, travelling with the refugee camp south to the Hubmouth and to the safety of Sada Amedu. She'd heard that they had overthrown their rulers and were creating a tolerant, cosmopolitan utopia. She's not foolish enough or naive enough to believe it, but she'd still hoped for a better than the lot she had now. She convinced herself that she'd carved out her own haven by mobilizing the untouchables in the camp just west of Bright Pass. She and her new friends from all over Latari had become a community that looked after one another, shared what little they had to ensure the survival of all. The Order helped. She was loath to admit that Godbotherers treated her and the other Scalies no different to the other refugees, and gave the Council of Displaced Nations no special treatment above the so-called untouchables. The Council were a nightmare, but balance, of a sort, seemed to have been achieved. Well enough so that everyone could coexist in the camp with minimal friction, and where cooler heads and conversation could prevail. But that was all before the raids and the pogroms. Some disaster, apparently, in the merchant quarter of the city, Mad had told her. That was the justification they used. Some group or other, the Sanguinario, the Blood Cult, as they become known, had seized portions of the commercial sector and run amok, slaughtering and mutilating the money classes before disappearing into the ether. And so the locals, starved of retribution, decided to turn their attention to the camps, blaming foreign elements and unpure races for attracting their attackers or colluding with them. The guard will protect us, Nad had said, again and again and again. Isenda wondered, despairingly, if Nad was still muttering this shielding mantra as the mob mutilated her tiny body. All of that was old news at this point. The council deflecting blame onto the Untouchables to protect their own. Forced march to Rainchapel to start over. The desperate, futile searching for missing wives, husbands, brothers, sisters, and children in the weeks that followed. The Guard and the Order had created a new camp for the Untouchables and repaired the damaged refugee camp. They'd sent their most naive and earnest young officers to try and smooth over the damaged trust. And worst of all, they posted guards at every entrance to the new site, giving their home a truly prison camp feel. Nevertheless, what had driven Isender to the breaking point was not this, nor was it watching as the gangs filled the security vacuum and removed the last semblance of community from her home. The straw which broke the camel's back was the spineless and cowardly letter she had received from her boyfriend in the city.
Who the fuck does he think he is?
Isender exclaimed as she paced backwards and forwards in her shared tent.
How fucking dare he come to me with his fucking excuses while he sits there in his cozy fucking palace, drinking warm fucking tea and sleeping in a soft fucking bed.
She could barely contain her rage, and her usually diverse vocabulary of curses and swear words had been reduced to only one.
What did you expect, Is? You never seriously thought he would be your knight in shining armor, did you?
Chura hissed, coiled up on the ground atop a fraying, grey bedroll, her soft voice almost drowned out by the driving rain.
I expected more than fucking nothing, Chura. I don't need him to be a gentleman. I don't need him to be kind. I just need him to get me the fuck out of this place before I wither and die.
The sentence began forcefully, but slipped slowly into sadness, and Isender's voice cracked with stress and pain.
It's your hope that keeps you wounded and fragile, sister. You must embrace reality.
Chura offered, with sympathy in her eyes.
Like you have. Pying up with Fujilo and his gang of fucking psychopaths.
Isender's eyes burned with rage as she rounded on her friend, lowering her chin so the serpentine Chura could see the points of the horns atop Isender's head.
Do not pass judgment on me, sister. I've done nothing more than you have done. I just aimed a little lower and succeeded where you have failed.
Chura met Isender's fiery gaze with an iron stare of her own.
You got tenderness and love for a time. The price you pay is your insecurity. I have insecurity for a time. The price I pay is a life without tenderness.
Chura's words took the wind out of Isender and brought an unwelcome tear to her eye. She brushed it away forcefully with the plain cloth arm of her garb before slumping down on the ground with her friend and wrapping her arms around her.
You still have my love, sister. You do not need a life without tenderness.
Isender's tears were flowing freely now.
How we found ourselves so low, throwing ourselves on the mercy of pathetic men.
Our time will come, Is. As sure as the end of days, it will come. But we must not allow ourselves to break before then, or we will have both lived and died as slaves. If Bracco has abandoned you for fear of his family and his reputation, use that fear to your advantage. You do not need his rescue, only his resources.
Thank you to Brent Wood for the use of the Banjo Blues instrumental. Thank you to Matt Wigton for the use of their song, The Next Adventure. Thank you to you for listening, and please tune in next time for another Tale from Sadra Medu, available on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.